and she has not texted or contacted anyone since. Coming up on 10 minutes after 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg, let's check WGTD sports and weather, shall we? Minor League Baseball, the Kenosha Kingfish and Rockford Rivets were rained out in Rockford last night. So tonight, the Kingfish and the Rivets play a doubleheader. Actually, it's this afternoon. First game's at 4:30 at Simmons Field. Both games will be seven innings. Major League Ball, Brewers beat Cincinnati. Cubs beat Washington. White Sox beat the Yankees. Tonight, the Brewers host Miami. Cubs play in Cincinnati. The White Sox host the Texas Rangers at Comiskey. A forecast from the National Weather Service. Cloudy and warm. 50-50 chance of rain today. High of 79. Right now, 66 degrees with a cloudy sky. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 11 after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg up next. Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. The morning show is next.
This weekend, the Smithsonian Channel is unveiling the first episode in a limited series that is quite exciting. It's called America in Color. And in this series, we are taking through the 20th century of the United States in really exciting fashion with extraordinary film footage not seen in many, many decades, and most of it colorized to bring to life in a really new and thrilling way our recent history. And I have just watched the episode that's devoted to the 1920s, and I was absolutely floored by how beautifully and in revealingly the story of the 1920s is told in this series. And I'm very, very excited to speak for the next few minutes with John Cavanaugh, who is executive producer for the Smithsonian Channel's limited series, again called America in Color. John Cavanaugh, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Ahead of us talking about this series, could you just say a word about the Smithsonian Channel and how it folds into the Smithsonian Institute that so many of us are well aware of and appreciate?
Sure. We are a sort of partner with the Smithsonian Institute. We actually were formed with the Smithsonian Enterprises, which is the commercial arm of the Institute, and CBS Showtime. So we are a private venture. Your tax dollars are not at work, but we do work with the museums very closely and search hard to develop projects that will showcase some of those, you know, their exhibitions and things that they're working on. And then their identities is very much part of who we are as a brand. So history and natural history and science and documentary television. And so, you know, we have a very close relationship with them, and we sort of try to sort of be the sort of television arm of America's Attic.
And I suppose that it is a filmmaker's dream to have access to the kind of archives that are housed at the Smithsonian. When it comes to, for instance, putting together a series like this?
Yeah, it can be. I mean, I think we are open to any archives all over the place. And actually, for this series, we got stuff from private collectors and private libraries, universities all over the country. I mean, I think, you know, we are a huge research is an immense challenge for a series like this. And I think the institution, obviously, research is a huge part of what they do, and I think that is a huge part of our identity, and that applies for this series more than anything else that I've ever worked on. I think we, with them, but also outside of the museums, we really scoured the country and the world to try to find some of these amazing stories. You know, for example, in the episode you just watched, the 1920 show, it opens with a terrorist attack in New York City, a bomb going off on Wall Street. That actually, we found that footage in a fragile canister that British Pathé had in a former nuclear bunker. And they opened the can, they tracked down this footage, had heard about this story, opened the can, and then it was empty. There was nothing in there. But we were able to rebuild the sequence from some other reels in British Pathé's library. But it's that kind of sort of Indiana Jones footage research that it takes. It was a massive effort.
Right. In the background, background information I was sent about this series, we were told that you and your colleagues spent nearly 6,000 hours painstakingly scouring obscure archives, dusting off forgotten family vaults, tracking down private collectors to find the 27 miles of film that in one way or another figures in this series. What an extraordinary effort that was. Just say a quick word about how one even approaches someone who has a film archive. In order to be granted access to it, and does it help that you have as esteemed a name as Smithsonian attached to you when you're making these overtures and requests?
It certainly helps. I mean, I think it's all about the stories in many ways. I mean, for this series, we would start by making a list of, okay, here, we're thinking about the 1920s, for example. Here are the stories we would love to tell in this episode. And then you start to think about where might we be able to find them? You know, how could we possibly show this kind of thing, especially in the 20s where footage is rare, a lot of it, some of it's been destroyed or lost, and you try to just basically follow the trail to see where you might be able to come up with some of this stuff. And then, you know, you start with the major institutions, the museums, and then, enormous, there are footage libraries, private and public, that you sort of go to, and then you often wind up finding, we're always looking for, specificity is the soul of narrative. So we're always looking for people to try to connect with and feature in the series. I know if you've seen the first episode, the whole movies appear in the series and are something that we use as a sort of recurring motif across the whole series to try to just give you a sense of what life was like for the people living during this time and just give you a different perspective. And often it's about finding these individuals, and then you track down their families, or maybe you get a lead on some of this footage, and then you have to contact the families and say, would you be willing to let us show this footage and use it? And it's just about, following the story as best you can to find the best possible footage. I mean, the ideal thing would be an amazing story that has amazing footage to cover it. And we try to sort of find that marriage for every beat that we have in the show.
Right. There are two other general points I want to make, and then I'm anxious to talk about a couple of specifics. One of them segues on what you were just saying. I think when we hear about a series like this, I think one fear is that you might be driven by the same desires as, for instance, the people who put together the 10 o'clock TV news, where the stories that get told are the stories with pictures or the stories where there is some visual element to them. And often that means that you leave off some really important story about the deficit because there's just no footage of that, or it's not visually arresting, even though it might be the most important story of the day. And likewise, it might be tempting, if you're putting a program like this together, telling the story of the 1920s, to only tell those themes or chapters of this story for which you have something to put on the screen. And yet, I have to say, after watching this, I think you've done an amazing job of telling the story of what happened in the 1920s and have found a way to do that. And I don't think you've fallen into the trap of leaving out of it important stories just because you didn't have footage to go with it. I mean, it's probably a combination of you've scoured the earth so thoroughly that you've found footage of all of these important stories. But I suspect that was not easy to accomplish.
It was a real challenge. I mean, I think we tried to find a balance. I think, you know, obviously it's an hour long program. So, you know, I wish that if we had 2 hours or 3 hours to spend on the 1920s, I think we could have found there are certainly more stories to tell, and we would love to tell them. I think it was about trying to figure out if this is a story that's so important that, you know, it has to fit into this. It has to be in this show. Then we sort of really say we have to be very creative about how we can find ways to tell it. I mean, you know, we felt like, okay, we need to do a story. You know, the history of the 1920s is historically, it's the roaring 20s, it's the boom, and you know that it's going to end in the Great Depression. And you try to figure out a way, well, how do we get prohibition and speakeasies, but also the African-American experience and just sort of all the sort of wide range of American life. You know, there's, you know, lots of footage of New York City, but how do we get footage from the Mississippi Delta? How do we get, you know, contain all this stuff that is America? And it's basically impossible, but we tried to make it feel like the series had a large scale so that you got the big picture of the decade, but also we could occasionally focus in on some of the individual moments and really immerse viewers in what life was like at the time.
Right. And I'm glad you mentioned the fact that you have some home movie footage because, you know, it's interesting how much exists from this and the decades after that is clearly sort of posed. Not that it's false, but it's certainly artificial. I mean, there's a camera rolling and it's not people really living their real lives. It's people, you know, riding in a car or something, but right, riding there for the camera, kind of preening for the camera. And it just, something feels not quite right. And I love the fact that there is so much fully authentic home movie footage, including, you tell us, some of the earliest home movies ever made.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there are some incredibly early stuff in here. You know, we have a sort of footage of Greenwood, Oklahoma, where there's this African-American community there, and this Baptist pastor, Solomon Sir Jones, is sort of just filming his life in this community, and it's just a slice of American life at that time that I, you know, certainly until I came to this project, I had never seen before. And it just, you find it really compelling. And I think the other thing about those movies is they're literally documentary in that they capture these moments around the edges, the little details, the color, well, that's where the colorization comes in. It's the color of the cars driving by or the clothes that they're wearing that bring to life this moment in history in a way that really you can't get in a lot of other places.
Absolutely.
Absolutely brings to life.
And you provided a nice segue into something else I wanted to talk about, namely the colorization of this footage from the 1920s. And I have to say, in all honesty, as I approached watching this, I thought that I was going to have a real issue with that, only because my own preference is when I'm watching, for instance, a film from the 1930s or the 1940s, if it was filmed in black and white, I would much rather see it in black and white and not in a colorized version. That's just my own preference. And so I wasn't sure how much I would enjoy this film because nearly all of this footage is colorized. I have to say, I'm really glad it was. I think it's colorized so well that it does not seem garish or terribly artificial. And there is something very inviting or enticing about that colorization. I applaud it, and I'm glad it was done. Can you just say a word about, first of all, the decision to do that and what was behind that, and also what kind of technical challenge it was to accomplish it, that is,
sure,
to colorize all this footage as convincingly as you have?
Yeah. I mean, I think the first thing is we started to look at what this footage, we saw some samples of what colorizing some of this footage looked like, and I think it's a combination of, technically, we can just do such amazing things now, scanning these films and bringing them up to 4K and then colorizing them, that the detail there, and I think I was kind of as surprised as you were, to be honest, when I first started looking at this stuff, is the detail and the quality is so engrossing that it's incredibly captivating. And I think, as you know, filmmakers and storytellers, we started to see it come to life on the screen, and we thought, man, this stuff is incredible. And it really is bringing something to these to this footage that isn't there, when you see it in its original condition. And I think when the series is at its absolute best, I think the color, marries into the storytelling in a way that really enhances what you're seeing. You know, the orange of the Golden Gate Bridge as it's first constructed, or, we went back and forth on trying to find the right color for the Wheaties box. It turns out the box was originally red. We had a Wheaties jingle, which was the first radio ad, and we were trying to figure out, we were showing the box, and we thought, well, what color was the box when this jingle came out? And it just, we went back and forth and back and forth, and finally we found out that it was, in fact, orange at that time, the sort of iconic orange. And it's that kind of thing where you can really draw people's attention to what the color is bringing to the story that I think really grabs people and makes the series incredibly engrossing. And I just think when you find yourself watching it and you just can't take your eyes off it.
It's really true. And again, I was personally surprised at how much it was that for me. I not only did I find myself not disliking the colorization, I actually deeply appreciated it. And I think one of the moments where it really, first of all, after a while, we even sort of forget about it, which is nice. I mean, I think that's a testament to how well it's done, that after a while, it just seems like that's what we're watching, and it ceases to be an issue. I remember being especially impressed by one crowd scene, and I can't remember now if it was one of the baseball scenes or Lindbergh's ticker tape parade or something, but there is a shot of all kinds of people in stands. And every coat is a slightly different color. And I just marvel at the time it must have taken to accomplish that colorization and to make it look as good as it does.
It did take an incredible amount of time. It's primarily a huge research job by our colorization teams. I mean, so, for those crowd shots at Yankee Stadium or Lindbergh's parade, or later we have MacArthur's return to New York after the war. I mean, it's just these huge crowds. A lot of that detail is there. If the original black and white image is good enough, you can sort of get the shades and colors of people's different coats and things that are in there. But a lot of it is also researching, fashions and styles at the time and just trying to find the right sources. And our amazing colorization team just spent, hours and hours going through this shot by shot. And it's a combination of, we wish it was as simple as, you find a computer program that just makes everything the right color. But there's software that can help, but it's also about doing the digging and finding the stories and finding out the details that tell you, okay, this coat is this color, or this dress was red, or, this was the color of Jack Dempsey's boxing shorts. We went back and forth on that for a while, and his trunks.
Hmm.
I mean, it's about digging in there and getting those stories, and then just very meticulously, frame by frame, going through and sort of bringing that color to life in a way that, feels as compelling as it does.
Hmm.
And it did take forever. It was a moving process.
Well done. We're speaking with John Cavanaugh, executive producer for the Smithsonian Channel's America in Color series. And they are unveiling the first episode this weekend, and it is devoted to the 1920s. I want to say that I really appreciated, again, the care that you took in telling this story, and often with footage we've never seen before, and often aspects of this decade that we don't think about. For instance, I think most of us, in our careless glance at history, tend to think of the 1920s as nothing but the Roaring Twenties, and it was just flappers and jazz and bootleggers and happy times until the stock market crash. Your program actually tells us that the decade began with very, very hard economic times in the wake of the First World War, and lots of veterans returning who were unemployed and long bread lines and so on. I mean, this is in 1920, not in 1929. That's a chapter of this decade I knew nothing about until I watched your film.
Yeah, that was very surprising to me as well. Certainly the shots you see in 1920 of veterans back from the war, or just everyday Americans. You know, they would look not out of place from the Great Depression at all. I think it goes to show you. I mean, I think we think of them as the Roaring Twenties, but it was an amazing boom decade for the country. And I think even the eventual collapse in the Great Depression still didn't quite change those. Didn't quite erase the progress that the country made during that time. I think, it just was a hugely transformational. Cars, radio, skyscrapers. You know, we have footage of the assembly of the Chrysler Building. I think all that stuff, it just completely transformed the American landscape. Huge migrations when the Mississippi flooded, that sent people, migrating all over the country, west and north to Chicago and to New York, and it just completely changed the scale of the country. And I think this episode, the 20s episode, I think is my favorite, and it, because it has this like just incredible feel of dizzying transformation, and then of course the huge explosion at the end that is, and the hangover that is the Great Depression comes in the 30s.
But, right,
it forever changed the country.
Of course, I especially, of course, as a radio announcer, took special delight in the time you take to talk about the advent of radio as this new medium that really helped bring this sprawling country together. And I was especially fascinated at the few seconds of footage there is of something in New York City called Radio Row, which is no longer there. Explain to our listeners what Radio Row was.
Radio Row was a strip in Manhattan, basically, that was like the sort of center, the place that sold more radios than any other place in the country or probably the world at the time. And we have this amazing street shot going down, and it's just nothing but awnings of radio shops and huge crowds. And it was sort of like radio burst onto the scene, essentially, and you went there, and that's where you bought your radio and took it home. And it was just that, it was the home of radio in America, and there were studios there. And it just, it was this amazing little slice of shopping life in Manhattan. But, go ahead.
And, of course, it's not there anymore because that's where the World Trade Center was built. And so
exactly.
that is a part of our history that now is gone. I was also especially fascinated by the discussion on the proliferation of automobiles and how there was no, in a sense, infrastructure in place to really handle that, and that the proliferation of car accidents was a real national tragedy. Explain to our listeners what we see in terms of some interesting educational efforts to get people to drive more safely.
Sure. I mean, there are some amazing campaigns. I mean, first of all, the Model Ts start rolling off the lines. We have incredible footage of them coming down. Then you see them driving around, and there's, they're kind of, initially, they're off-roading, going across rivers and streams. But then increasingly in the cities, traffic just skyrockets. You went from a time when you have horse carriages, going through New York City streets or Chicago streets. And then all of a sudden, but there's no laws, there's no traffic lights, there's no efforts to sort of negotiate or maintain public safety, and people are just sort of willingly driving the cars wherever they want. And so there are huge statistics of fatalities. We have one of our home movies is of a family who has their son. We see him early, and then a year later, he was struck by a car. And he's one of, I think, four boys in a two-week span to get hit by a car in that area, and he was killed. But that sparked this sort of national campaigns of we have an incredible shot of a sort of parade of cars, trucks hauling wrecked cars, saying his mind was on his business, I think is written on one of them, and the car is smashed. And there's the Grim Reaper. It's like a parade of basically car wrecks, and talking about how people need to pay attention. It's like you sort of like don't text while driving.
Absolutely. But here we are in 1926.
Exactly.
It's fascinating. And I also want to make brief mention of the amazing footage you have of certain skyscrapers being constructed. And with cameras up at the very, very top of these skyscrapers, and we see these workers defying death. And it's just amazing to have those kind of images captured.
Yeah, of course, there are no safety nets or anything, and you see them up there flinging hot rivets up 20 feet to each other to catch, you know, and they're just sitting on these girders, you know, hundreds of feet above the ground, you know, 100 stories up, and they're working up there, and you can see the Empire State. We have the Empire State Building coming up. You have them putting on the sort of eagles that are on the, you know, around the edge of the Chrysler Building, which are great. You see them coming on, and they're actually surprisingly lightweight. You can see them sort of bending, sort of they almost look like aluminum kind of eagles as they're sort of mounting them on the building. But you see these guys up here at incredible heights, and you get this view of New York at the time, which looks completely different, of course, than what it does now. But you're getting it sort of from this moment. So it's both documenting their work, which was incredibly dangerous and completely changed the city, but also you see what their perspective of was what New York was like in that particular moment, and it really sort of brings the era to life.
And, of course, the decade is also the decade of jazz. It's the decade of Charles Lindbergh, but also the decade of some catastrophes, of the horrific flooding of the Mississippi River, of one of the most terrible hurricanes in our history, and, of course, the disaster which befalls the whole country at the end of the decade with the crash of the stock market. And all of those stories are told here in absolutely amazing fashion. So the Smithsonian Channel releases the first episode of its America in Color series this weekend. And it's available through AT&T UVerse or DirecTV or Dish Network, or one can go to the Smithsonian Channel's website at least to view this very first episode, which airs across the country then on Sunday. John Cavanaugh, executive producer for the Smithsonian Channel's America in Color, congratulations on a superb film. I enjoyed it so much, and best wishes with all that you and the Smithsonian continue to produce.
Thank you very much. Hope everyone enjoys the series.
Part two of today's morning show coming up in just a moment here on WGTD. And for this portion of WGTD's morning show, I'm really pleased to welcome back into our studios Chris Paulson, who is executive director of the Racine Heritage Museum. And we're going to give him a chance to give just a little bit of an overview about the Racine Heritage Museum, but then focus a little more specifically today on a really exciting opportunity that people have through the summer months to go on a heritage walking tour through the heart of Racine. And it's an absolutely wonderful idea. It's something I look forward to taking part in one of these days. And Chris Paulson is going to tell us all about it. Chris Paulson, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here. Ahead of talking about your heritage walking tours, let's find out a little bit overall about the Racine Heritage Museum. And once in a while, I tend to still call you by your former name. I think the Racine Heritage Museum used to be called something else.
Well, its legal name is the Racine County Historical Society and Museum, and that really speaks to what we do. The museum is the custodian of an incredible collection, the material culture of Racine County. We care for approximately 200,000 objects and an amazing archival documentary collection that consists of over a mile of linear feet of original source material, all related to the unique history of Racine County.
How long have you been there?
I stopped counting. I'm thinking 28 years this year.
Wow. So you are obviously very, very happy there, and it is a wonderful place to visit if one is interested in the history of Racine, which is, I mean, I should think every small city in America is interesting to some extent, but I think it's fair to say that there is something especially intriguing and complex about the city of Racine. It has all kinds of stories that not every small city has to tell.
No, that's true. It's amazing. It's unique, and it's a county story. It starts out as a major wheat producer and shipper. We had one of the busiest commercial ports on the Great Lakes for a number of years, and wheat that was raised in the west end of the county was shipped out on the east, and they built a unique infrastructure that they employed rather creatively during the years leading to the Civil War to aid and abet and help fugitive slaves escape through the county to freedom in the north. And you know, that just kind of speaks to a creativity and an innovative spirit that really characterizes the industrial age to come and the amazing diversity of manufactured products that this community can boast, and its position in the world is just absolutely staggering when you think of it, and really relative to its size. It's just fascinating.
Right. So over the course of your many years, you said 28 that you've been at the museum, what kind of changes have taken place? I mean, I'm thinking primarily of within those four walls, and also maybe even more importantly, how has what you do changed? And I don't mean you so much personally, but the museum in carrying out its mission.
Well, museums everywhere really have had to sort of step up their game to compete with, you know, the electronics. Really, it started out, we were competing against video games, I guess, early on, but other sort of experiential things that are out there. And what we have done is to really kind of emphasize outreach. We've engaged the community in a variety of different ways. We've really amped up our exhibit program at the museum over the last dozen years or so. We've completely reformed the exhibit offering that the museum has. Things are very immersive. They're very interactive, and they're developed along with our educators so that they can be used to support the curriculum of an education program that's really growing at the museum right now. And we're taking that one step further each year where we're, you know, engaging seniors, we're engaging students, and now we're bringing them together around the stories that we tell. And so it's just been a wonderful thing to just sort of be person to person now rather than offering a sort of a static experience for people.
We're speaking with Chris Paulson, executive director of the Racine Heritage Museum, and we want to spend our remaining time focusing on what are known as heritage walking tours, something which the museum is offering through the summer months. I think you just began last weekend. First of all, I'm trying to remember, is this something that the museum has offered before, or is this a new offering?
No, it's new. We've been talking about it. This really is the brainchild of a good friend of ours, Jim Wardrop, who has been active in the museum and in the preservation community, well, all over Racine. Everybody knows Jim. But the idea he brings to this program is based on his own experience visiting other communities, and you know, we've all done this on vacations where you take a little historic tour trip, you know, or you walk a ghost tour or something like that in a community, and the takeaway from that and the research indicates that people that take time to learn about the history of a community are more likely to return to it. So you know, there's benefit to be gained from something like this, where if we can engage people, you know, in the history of the community, people that aren't, you know, might not have come here otherwise, you know, maybe we can get them to come back and, you know, buy lunch, spend some money, and spend more time in the community. And so it's really based in that, we were very fortunate to have a grant from the Real Racine, the Convention and Visitors Bureau, to support marketing this program outside of Racine County.
So I'm sure you sat down and had some probably extensive conversations on exactly how to do this. And, of course, you're quite right. A number of cities do things like this and variants on it and so on. And you could have done it in a number of different ways. One of the choices you've made is that these tours are guided.
Yes.
And tell us more about the way in which it is a guided tour experience.
They are guided. We have these wonderful volunteer tour guides. Each one of them has an extensive knowledge of area history. Each one of them has a kind of a unique take on it. And in Racine, every corner has 100 stories that that are fascinating for people. And so we developed a tour that, I could go down to the museum archive and kind of find some great sites that I think matter. But we brought potential tour guides along with us in the process of putting this thing together. And through that process, developed an approach that allows people to kind of emphasize their own interests and their own strengths, and also kind of carry a basic script forward. But since there are so many stories, and you've only got an hour and 20 minutes to tell it, we're leaving quite a bit of leeway with these tour guides. But there's because there is so much information. But they're there to also help participants take a deeper dive into the stories if they would like to. And since the tours begin and end at the museum, you know, that opportunity is there for them to walk right in the door and learn more about some of the stories they've just heard.
Great. And that also suggests that one might conceivably take this tour more than once, because almost certainly it will not be exactly the same tour. I mean, it will follow roughly the same journey, I mean, yes. Geographical mm-hmm. journey, but in terms of the stories you will hear or exactly what you'll learn, probably from tour to tour, there will be some variation there.
That's right.
Very good. So how did you decide then? I don't know, do we call it an itinerary sort of? But I mean, the route of these tours, you could have done that in so many different ways. Describe what the route is and also the process by which this route was chosen.
Well, there were two criteria that I had in mind. Others had, Jim certainly had his thoughts, and then our amazing office manager Christiana Schlitz she's an organizer that, you know, with just mad skills there, and so I wanted to connect the story of the development of the downtown area to its geography. That's something I wanted people to see. I wanted people to see the lakefront, the riverfront, the harbor, the low levels where, you know, the kind of the cradle of industry in the area, and to see just the different segments of the downtown community. And so we kind of picked a tour that, you know, walked through those areas. We had stories that we wanted to be sure we pointed out to people. We wanted it to be a comfortable tour, so we weren't making people, you know, climb cliffs or, you know, whatever, or, you know, lots of stairs or anything like that. And we wanted to emphasize a number of different key elements of the story that we're trying to bring forth, which is simply that Racine is a uniquely diverse place in terms of its people, in terms of its manufactured output, and the stories that surround that just simple core really kind of set their own itinerary. And then we realized we didn't want to have to be dragging people through the community for, you know, 2 and 3 hours while we're pointing out every single site. Christiana went to work on this map, and we wound up with a tour that takes approximately an hour and 20 minutes. Gets you to all the right vistas, and back to the museum in time for lunch.
One of the frustrations, I suppose, that would be part of putting something like this together is that there are all kinds of important things that are no longer there.
Right.
So how much is that reality reflected in this tour? How much of the tour do you spend pointing at the city block and saying, this used to be X, now it's Y.
Well, we have the good fortune of that extensive archive I mentioned that we mined for a bunch of photographs. So we have, each tour guide has a binder full of historic photographs of the areas that we're walking through, and can point out buildings that were there, and you can kind of see the way things have changed.
So in other words, people are not just left to their own imagination that there used to be a beautiful hotel here,
right,
or Porter's Furniture used to be here, but they can actually be shown a photograph right there on the spot.
That's right.
It's a great idea. It's a great idea. I understand that there is a point in the tour, and I don't know, maybe this is something that's intended to be a little bit of a surprise, but I've seen it mentioned in two different stories, but there is some point in the tour where people see a place where people actually would travel under the street, close to where the gelato cafe is. Does that sound familiar?
Yes, but I'll leave that as a surprise
for
the people that take
it. All right. Okay, that's fine. Like I said, I only mentioned it because I've seen it in an article or two, but yes, it sounds like it'll be a moment where the tour kind of takes a diversion that is a little bit unexpected and sounds pretty cool. I know that part of what's really important with any tour that involves Racine is an exploration of some of its major industrialists. Mm-hmm. How does that happen on the tour?
When you walk through the downtown area, you're going to be introduced to, you're going to see the major names that we, of course, can boast in this community, S.C. Johnson. We can talk about Case because of, you know, the threshing machine company. You're going to walk right past a place where you can see those. You learn about fractional horsepower motors that were invented in the community and produced by so many different people. And we'll see, you know, so every place has a relationship with one of the great industrialists in the community somehow that we can talk about. They were people that were members of the historic churches, people that were in civic leadership, people that had other business interests in the community in addition to being in industry. So we can relate stories to them throughout the tour.
Hmm. My understanding is people need to be 12 years old or older, and that probably makes sense. This is not really something intended for young children.
Right, right. I think, you know, just in general, you know, the subject matter and we just want to avoid fatigue. You know, we don't want to wear anybody out.
Right. And it says that groups will be limited to 20, which also makes sense because there's something really kind of unwieldy when you talk about groups that are a lot bigger than that, and it ends up being a relatively intimate situation, and I suppose just a little more workable.
Right. Yeah. You've got a tour guide that has a lot to talk about, and there are going to be a lot of questions, and we want to make sure that the information can get out and people can have their questions answered.
Mm-hmm. So logistically, how does this work if somebody is interested in doing this? First of all, exactly when do these tours occur, and do people just show up at the time, or how does logistically does that work?
They occur. The tours take place every Saturday through September 9th at 10:30 in the morning and at 1 in the afternoon. We meet on the steps of the museum at 7th and Main Street. The tours are rain or shine. We do have umbrellas we can provide people if they need. The best way to sign up for a tour, we do ask for reservations in advance. We'd like you to try to get those reservations in at least a week ahead. But by any means, just call the museum. I'll give you the number in a second. But the best way to do it is to visit our website, www.racineheritagemuseum.org. And you'll find easy steps on how to sign up for the tour and how to reserve for the tour. If you have questions, call us. Call Christiana at 262-636-3926, and she can answer any question and help you get onto a tour.
Mm-hmm. The cost for the tour is what?
$8 a person.
Mm-hmm. So it already has happened one Saturday. I'm trying to remember, what was Mother Nature? Was she kind to you last Saturday?
Yes, and we had a very good start to the tours. And we actually had a special group come through of journalists from around the country that are in the state for the Frank Lloyd Wright dedications, and we were very fortunate to be able to have half a dozen of them join us on the tour, and Mother Nature held off until exactly the last minute.
Very good. Well, I'm glad that that was able to happen. So do you have particular people in mind to take advantage of this? That is, does this make more sense for somebody who is from Racine and already knows Racine, or is this more for somebody who has no idea about this rich history of Racine? I mean, has it been conceived with a particular sort of consumer in mind?
Well, it was conceived with the idea that we would be inviting people from outside the community in and engaging them in the history of our area. We have people that live here seasonally that may not be aware of the history of the community. But, you know, there are people that live here, that grow up here, that also don't know or have a knowledge and want to learn more or want to engage, you know, somebody else that has a background and a certain emphasis that they can offer, in terms of the story of the community. So, you know, really it's reaching a number of people within and outside of the community. I've been very pleased to, you know, hear the response from people that live in Racine that say, I want to go on the tour. You know, it appeared in the paper, and people started reserving that live in town too. And so it's really an opportunity for everybody.
Very good. So again, these heritage walking tours in downtown Racine occur every Saturday for the remainder of the summer into the first part of September. Mm-hmm. And people should call the museum ahead of time to reserve a place for one of these guided tours that will take you right through the heart of Racine. Again, a walking tour that takes about an hour and 20 minutes. So people should think about, is that something they're physically capable of? And if the answer is yes, then by all means, this is an exciting opportunity that people should hesitate to take advantage of. One more time, the phone number and website address for the museum?
The phone number is area code 262-636-3926, and the website is www.racineheritagemuseum.org.
And otherwise, when is the museum open for people to come by and visit?
We're open 6 days a week, Tuesday through Friday, 9 to 5, Saturday from 10 to 3, and Sunday from noon to 4.
Very good. Chris Paulson is the executive director of the Racine Heritage Museum. Chris, great to see you again, and we hope a lot of people will take advantage of this marvelous opportunity to take one of these heritage walking tours in the heart of Racine and otherwise to visit all of the interesting things at the Racine Heritage Museum. Thanks for being part of the morning show today.
Thanks very much for having me.
On Monday's morning show, you'll hear my conversation with Dr. Jeff Thompson, who is CEO Emeritus of the Gunderson Healthcare System, one of the most highly regarded healthcare providers in the country. They're based in La Crosse. And Dr. Thompson has written an interesting book about his leadership principles called Lead True. And you'll hear from him on Monday's morning show. There's no morning show on Tuesday because of the 4th of July, but on Wednesday, among other things, we'll give you a preview of this year's Four Seasons Garden Club Secret Garden Tour in Kenosha. Linda Guy will be joining us to talk about that. We'll have several other interesting conversations next week, including a week from today, a conversation with a college professor at Georgetown University, Dr. Jacques Berlinerblau. He has written a book called Campus Confidential, in which he takes a rather hard-hitting look at the state of higher education in America. Dr. Berlinerblau has a lot of grave concerns, chief among them the fact that he believes too many colleges and universities do not take seriously enough the primary task at hand, namely teaching their students well. You can hear about his provocative book 1 week from today on The Morning Show. Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses designed for the working adult. Information at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe.